next presenter is Larry Funk. Larry was in the workshop of the think tank. He was here last year. He's Bombardier Chair of the Sustainable Transportation at the University of British Columbia and a non-senior resident at the Brookings Institute. Interesting work on transportation and the relationship, I believe, groundbreaking work, relationship between transportation and health. Please.
Thank you, Avi. Good morning. This follows nicely on Liz's and Ian's presentation. Some people argue, or it is amazing, how the connection between land use and transportation is often argued as being, I think particularly in civil engineering, it's raised as a question is how are the two linked? Are they linked? And I always think back to that transportation actually is the single largest land use itself. Not only are they connected, they are in fact the same thing. One of the things that we think about, and I've been interested all along, is measuring the relationship. So I'll get into this a bit. I was told to focus on and think what's interesting is, and actually I want to ask a question, if it would be okay with you if we use the collective media,
sure.
And not, that'd be just helpful for me. Thank you. So one of the things is, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to share any information with you after. Okay. So, is how we spend our money. This is the what happened to me was I went through school getting a degree in engineering and in urban planning, and I think at some point my what is it? You have a there's a surgical procedure. It's a deviated where you actually they separate your brain apart. So I used to go, and it was like the left brain and the right brain people. In the morning, I was over. This is the left brain model. And I'll have the right brain one right after this. But it actually helps in a way, is the linear thinking is that we spend money on transportation and land use. We make all these decisions, and there's two aspects. There's how it's designed, and Liz presented on the design piece very well. And then there's where growth goes. So the big argument in climate and in health is where's the win-win between the two. And it has a lot to do not just with how we design, but where the growth goes, if it's at the edge or if it's in the middle or near transit or not. So both where and how apply where we spend our dollars. But what we have done is we have systematically and really almost an incredible mastery externalized the health and transportation costs of these decisions on the front end. So we now need to monetize the health costs within the transportation decision-making process and the land development process. That's health impact assessment, effectively. And that probably will feed in nicely to your talk, I hope. So then the idea is that, well, you know, what we know as evidence is that, you know, these decisions then affect, we believe the causal, while data on causation, the next arrow, activity patterns, may be limited, I think we know that it does. Everybody can remember different places they have lived and made different travel choices because of that location. It had inherently different opportunities and costs and benefits and trade-offs. You're still the same person with the same preferences, but in a different location for different reasons. So I think we know that there's a relationship here. It is causal, and we now have evidence, and I'll get to that today, I hope. And there's these outcomes. We care about these outcomes, and there's more. There's mental health and social interaction. And then, again, this externality. So this is the right brain model. It's the same idea. And I tried to put a dollar sign in the middle last night graphically in a poor way. It was very late. Anyway, so, but you can see, I mean, you know, this is just showing, but, you know, our health affects how active we are. So we have a lot of, when we got into the health piece about, you know, 15 years ago, and I was fortunate to write the very first report on the effect of the built environment on physical activity for the CDC in 1998. And this was, you know, we'd been doing this for 10 years. There was like about four of us studying this. My dissertation was looking at mixed use and density effects on walking, driving, and transit. And we started in 1989, and the Charter for the New Urbanism had already been out, but there wasn't really that many people looking at this question. So this is a little bit of a philosophical approach, is really bridging knowledge and action and trying to apply to work on things that we can actually act upon. And then this cross-disciplinary connection, which I think is something we should use as a metric of success. The degree to which we are able to traverse across our disciplinary boundaries is critical, and many of you are doing this, I'm well aware of. We do need an evidence base. There's a wonderful quote. A guy named Larry Green wrote this book on health promotion, and it's been used, but he says, if you want an evidence-based practice, you need practice-based evidence. And it's the two are interchangeable back and forth, and it's essential that we do that in the opportunities to intervene. I think this came very clear across in Liz's presentation, but this is just some graphics I use to convey two phenomena that have to do with how, not where, but design, proximity, and connectivity. And this is embedded in the charter of the new urbanism, but basically proximity is mixed use and density. So how far away is it to get to a complementary, functionally complementary type of use? And you can see in the suburban model on the left what that squiggly line is. It articulates the what is how we do our research, which is what you can get to on the ground. So something can be very nearby, can be right over here, but you can't get to it. And we designed it. It's called defensible space. I think that was Oscar Neumann's term. And basically, housing and urban development in the U.S. used that model, and it was embedded in all of our regulations that are now we're trying to break down and rework. A lot of good work has happened on that, but this is an older community. You can just see when you measure it using parcel data, which is how we build measures that then predict travel. You can see, you know, things are nearby that are much different. You can walk to a store over here. You can't because there is no store. So forth. Now over here, you just see the connectivity effect is measured directly, but 1 kilometer versus two, a walkable or not, based on the road network characteristics, same distance. So we take all these measures and just show you how research is done like this. It just shows Vancouver, many colleagues of mine, and we have in 10 regions in North America, we compile all these measures, and then we compare how people travel who live in these different levels of walkability. And just to show you, like in Canada, when I came to Canada 7 years ago, there was almost, in the U.S. there had been a lot of research on this, but there was almost none in Canada that had really quantified the travel impacts of urban form. So we started doing a little bit of it, but we just show people who live within who have a grocery store within walking distance were 50% more likely to get the amount of physical activity they need. So grocery stores really matter, obviously. Probably the single most important land use in a community is food destination, and recreation would be right next to it, access to transit and so forth. Employment would be nice, more difficult often to accomplish, and people in neighborhoods with traditional shopping streets lined with shops, that granularity that Liz was talking about, small shops and a fine grain, were half as likely to be overweight than people who had to drive. So this is a couple examples. This is just pulling another study in Vancouver that we just completed, and it just simply points out at levels of significance based on number of stars, all these urban form factors, and how they relate with whether people use transit in this case. We look at walking and driving as well. And then for things that are essential or non-discretionary or discretionary, you can start to see, you know, what seems to matter most. And we just look at this for walking. Urban form is in the main point between the two slides. As you can see, these factors are significant in many instances, urban form along these different factors. But what you see is for walking, they're even more significant. And you'd expect it because we're very sensitized to walking. We're exposed to the environment. It has to be very, these factors seem to predict quite a bit. So you can see it makes sense that non-work, open parks and open space should matter more. And it does. So that was just some things to show. A concern. This is a study we just released this week. Julian Marshall, Michael Brower, and I just finished. It's now actually come out in Environmental Health Perspectives, where no question, hands down, increasing the walkability of communities is health promoting. We know this. Except for some people, it has a risk. Air pollution exposure is higher in the more walkable places. So the biggest concern I have is that this will be misinterpreted, this study, which I'm sure it will be. But we did, we measured. So there's two kinds of pollutants. One is small particulates that track with nitrogen. This is like a marker. It's a proxy variable. So you can see where the air pollution is the worst for particulates is in the downtown and along these major corridors. But it's only like 200 feet or 100 feet back from roadway edge. And then they're out of the air. So basically, we can come up with new models and design strategies for housing that might, or where we locate seniors that are the most at risk. Others, you know, most of us, it's not that much, it's not a problem. But we have to be careful because there are risks. So concentrating development in smaller areas can lead to increased exposure to harmful air pollutants, these small particulates. However, density is a solution because if you're more than three floors up, the particulates are near the ground. So actually, this is a really important result, is that verticality, which we get from compact development, is a mitigation strategy for exposure to bad air in more compact environments. I didn't even put that up here, but I remembered it. I wanted to mention it. So it's a concern for elderly, and we need to be careful about not solving one problem while creating another. The health effects of exposure to bad air is a serious issue. You know, it's not like we need to deal with that. It's actually, there's a lot of evidence. Ozone kills. We know it, and we know particulates are a trigger for myocardial infarction or heart attack for in the elderly. So looking at some examples of where we've, on the transit supportive side in Seattle, I just want to mention that we look at a number of different variables and non-home work travel. This is just an example. Modest changes in urban form, like a 10% increase in density, which is minuscule really, is associated with a 2.4 or 2.3% increase in transit demand. We have results. These are just elasticities, is what this is called, and we import these findings, I'm just showing an example, into a tool that we try to use to predict for local governments how, when you go build a development, you know, what configurations can you accomplish and how would they perform in accordance with objectives like reducing automobile use or promoting transit. Increasing connectivity, meaning the number of intersections where people live, by 10%, very modest, was associated with, you see, like a certain percentage, 2.8% increase in walking. You may go, that's not that much. A 10% change in density is not that much either. So you could go 20%, 30%. They're probably not completely linear, but at some point, you know, you'd have a reduction. But there are effects, and this is like air pollution and neighborhood design, just showing what matters most. Increasing intersection density per square mile. As the number of intersections increase, we move towards a more compact grid. And volatile organic compounds that people generate, no question air pollution generation is reduced with increased walkability. The problem is when you get into this issue of exposure, which we're now only getting into in our research, and others will look at it too, but we see connectivity is like a very important factor where people live, but where they work, working in a neighborhood where the retail FAR, meaning there, picking up the walkability of a neighborhood by knowing the ratio of floor space of a building to land area. It's basically picking up how much surface parking is wrapped around suburban office buildings, more or less. And as you increase the FAR and have, you know, the building set up to the curb as opposed to behind a sea of parking, as was shown in the graphic that Liz showed the New Urbanist have used, you can start to see the relationship is that that's one of our best predictors of travel, is FAR. So that means that should translate directly into policies for how we design and govern development. So greenhouse gas emissions is sort of, it follows just like any other form of emissions. If you drive less, you pollute less. It's a tremendously complex relationship, right? But anyways, so you can see density, retail parcels. This is an interesting one. This gets at grain. We start to see a break point where you have to have, you know, a certain number, a critical mass of destinations near where you live if you're really going to walk. Having a few restaurants, or maybe two, or one store isn't really going to change your behavior that much. Typically, you got to have a lot to get to. And we see connectivity, again, in related to greenhouse gas emissions. Youth travel is very important right now and going to stay important for us for, I think, the foreseeable future. We should really understand what affects whether or not kids walk and how to design communities so they'll walk to not only school but to other destinations. For the youngest kids, this is what's this color, fuchsia, is where we found significant relationships. Having a recreational or open space mattered for any age range of youth. You see the age ranges across the top. These are large sample sizes, reasonably, relatively speaking, to other data that's been available. And this study came out 3 years ago. It's been published in a health journal. I'm actually an urban planner who published most of my research in health journals. It's weird, you know, and actually it's only weird because our society hasn't accepted that yet, but when it, but within academia, this is not often easy. You have to, you know, it's the trade-offs. But anyways, 9 to 11-year-olds, we see density matters. All that's picking up is distance to school. So when we measure distance to school, it's just capturing that. So what that means is we better put a lot of higher density housing around our schools. We have independent boards that make school siting decisions. Even in Florida, which has growth management and concurrency, which is a rule trying to put development, more complex, but there's regulations. Schools are actually out of the regulatory framework. They're independent, and this is a critical issue. So we see housing policies, school siting, and land use policies of governance around schools is very important because what we've learned, actually we have a whole separate study I won't go into today, but distance to school completely overrides anything else. So, you know, we can measure density and mix and connectivity and all that. For kids travel to school, it means nothing. My students went out and measured the sidewalks between where 10-year-olds live and go to school and the intersection quality and the quality of the sidewalks and all that. And it was insignificant and didn't matter at all. And my student came back, this is about 3 years ago, she goes, all upset. She goes, I had no significant relationships. I spent 2 years on my thesis. And I said, just select out the kids that are a half a kilometer from school and come back with an analysis. And it came out to be very significant. So what the deal is that you distance map overrides everything else, and urban design doesn't even matter if you don't get the distances right. And then 12 to 15-year-olds, everything matters. So you get everything mattering. And you can see all these are, you know, pretty significant relationships, whether or not they walked. And then 16 to 20, so this leads to an observation where at 16 years old, obviously something happens, they get access to a car. So, you know, changing built environments and all is what we're, you know, primarily interested in, I am personally, and think that's the foundation strategy that everything else rests upon. But in the nearer term, to get both health and climate benefits, we really need to get at this, which is vehicle ownership. So we did some comparative and saw youth from households with two cars were 1.4 times more likely to walk at least once over compared. We compared those who had three or more cars to two. And the two, they're 1.4 times more likely to walk. Well, that may mean that we could, in fact, have some policies that say, you know, you can have two cars or one car, but every additional car is exponentially more expensive. Right now, it's actually the opposite. And you can see 2.6 times if one car, and well, not fair, 7.7 times. If you have no cars, of course, you have to walk. So a lot of work is now happening on climate. And obviously, what we're learning, we've done a study for Brookings we hope to have come out soon, and really fuel mix. These are the technological advancements, this one and this one, and that can get you half the way there is what we're learning, only half. Even in the best case of circumstances by 2050 to get an 80% reduction, if you want the other 40%, we're going to have to change our behavior. So we're kind of backed into a corner, and technology is not going to solve this one. So here's our numbers that we learned, and you can see that we assume major progress is pretty aggressive on the technological side, and we assume cars in the U.S., average car is getting under 20 miles per gallon right now. This was tested in Seattle. So it's more than a doubling of fuel economy. You know, some cars will get 100, but others won't. And we reduce fuels by this much, and that's what we're told we can get. It means the average person in Seattle in 2050 can only drive 8.4 miles per day. Now, the average person right now drives 27. So basically, what we're basically saying is an urban form has to occur that enables people to only drive one-third the amount they are today, taking into account population growth. So if you're only going to be able to drive one-third, you're going to have to be able to walk more and take transit more, and that's going to help on the health side. So we really need to work cross agendas. So I think I just jump ahead and just say, you know, there's scenario planning is critical, working with designers to come up with and communities and developing tools that people can figure out real time, you know, in a neighborhood, here's our place types, here's what we have, and how does it perform? And we've run through just real quick before I conclude. An example, this is in Seattle. There was a neighborhood called White Center, and it's a commercial core, and there is a low-income housing development going in right here, and there was very poor connection between the two. So we modeled that and tested, you know, if you put a better pedestrian connection, what would you get? And this just shows the pedestrian connection in place. We saw, you know, just in greenhouse gas emissions, and then we measured body weight and physical activity. It's a little bit cut off, but measured objectively. And what we saw is really, if you put a pedestrian connection in, you don't get any change in greenhouse gas emissions for the most part, because most of the travel is longer distance. That pedestrian connection doesn't do you much in the local area. But we see 10% reduction or increase in physical activity, which isn't bad for a little sidewalk effectively connecting a development. You know, but we had to really make transit happen before we started to see reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. So I think I'm going to move towards conclusion and just say there's a lot of ways that people can, you know, this is data, but decision-making is what matters. So that's the art of what we're to talk about. And just to show, you know, we can predict where in Seattle people pollute a certain amount, but it's only because a guy was the head of King County for a long time, who was my client, Ron Sims, who's now Deputy Secretary of HUD, that this map exists, because he wanted to know how he can charge developers a fee based on where they're going to develop based on the predicted greenhouse gas emissions. There's a model in place that has been upheld by the California Supreme Court, which is the indirect source rule in the San Joaquin Air District, and that's now being taken statewide in California. They have a proposition, SB 375, their Senate bill, which is an enforced law now, that they have to come up with ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions based on land use. So basically, this has been tested as well in Washington, and I think there are some ways that we can proceed. I didn't get to the residential preference piece, but my summary comments are basically strategies that we should look at are things that I think location-efficient mortgage lending is a key one. This, you know, the point is making the business case. So there is an unmet demand for more walkable places. We know this. I was going to show the graphs, and there's a lot of data. There's a number of papers out now. There's research on this. We know that when we are able to successfully build new urbanist communities or walkable places, they seem to be selling. They're certainly holding their land value now in the decline. And where the defaults are occurring, maps, you can go to the Center for Neighborhood Technology website, Scott Bernstein's work. You can see maps that just show across North America, all of the defaults are occurring at the edge. They're not occurring in the middle. So the only thing that you can isolate that's spiking up and down is energy price. Everybody else is exposed to the same economic conditions, and that's a factor that could be the tipping point that's causing default, and it's externalized from our mortgage lending process. So if we were to actually bring transportation costs into mortgage lending, we actually potentially could help the banks and our own financial future. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you.